Oh, yeah. Howlin' for My Darlin' from Debbie Davies on KLCC's Fresh Tracks. Blues guitar goddess Debbie Davies graces KLCC with her presence this afternoon on Fresh Tracks. The Blues Music Award winner is in town tonight for a performance at Rockin' Rodeo. Her latest recording on Telarc Records is called Blues Blast. You can count on her rocking the house tonight with her tough driving style of blues. Welcome, Debbie Davies.
Thank you, Liz. It's great to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here. I've been listening to your music for years and have always loved what you do. You're a great blues woman. Music started to become your calling at a very young age, and your parents were both professional musicians. Talk about your beginnings and what your impressions were as a young girl and how this all evolved into achieving your dream to be a blues musician. I remember knowing that I wanted to be a DJ when I was pretty young, so I would fantasize, and I had a tape recorder with a microphone and, you know, KLIZ. So what were your dreams like when you were a little girl? And
well, I was never not around music, and I remember being about 3 years old and sitting with, you know, leaning against what we didn't have stereo then. It was mono, so there was one speaker. And the music was on, and I realized I knew where it was going. I just had that, I know where it's going, and I could kind of hum along. So I was starting to figure out what it actually was. I remember that at three and getting pretty excited. But as a young person, I had the obligatory piano lessons. My mom is a really accomplished classical pianist, and she had taught school, you know, music and the school system, and my dad was a singer in the kind of Hollywood, you know, studio scene. Like, he did, you know, all the backup stuff for movies and records and commercials, and so he was always writing arrangements and stuff at the piano, and so both of them, piano was kind of their thing, and I think it was natural to want to have my own thing. But I also think everybody has their own instrument. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I saw guitars, like everybody my age, you know, we saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. We're like, oh, my God. So I wanted guitar. And I started on acoustic when I was 12. And the next year wanted an electric. But, you know, back in those days, as it were, there wasn't really support for women at all, females, to play in bands, period, you know. So if you weren't singing or playing a flute or the piano, you know, you really couldn't do it. So my parents refused to buy me an electric guitar. And there were, you know, it was like a boys' club. You couldn't hang out with anybody playing. So I sort of had put that dream on the shelf and just strummed away on my acoustic, you know, and learned songs and could sing and play, which is good. But I got out of high school, and I was, like, puttering around in college and jobs and whatnot. And at the age of 24, I realized I still want to play electric. And I just started. I bought myself one, and I was going to school and working and doing all that and just started doing it. I mean, I was and then at that point, I made a real big commitment, and I was going out to I was living in Northern California then. And going to blues clubs at night and seeing all the real cats play and buying the records and sitting around with the guys that, you know, knew how to play and just trying to absorb. So it was a long path, but music was always my passion. I mean, that wasn't really a question for me. I would certainly, as a kid, I remember making, you know, the cardboard guitar. Like, your parents would buy a big refrigerator or a washer dryer, and you'd have that giant cardboard box. And then we would draw, my girlfriend and my sister and I would, you know, be the Beatles. So we had to cut out these, you know, electric guitar, and I drew, you know, all the stuff on it, you know, copied from a picture, and had a piece of yarn as the, you know, strap. So, and we were the air guitar, you know, Beatle girl band, but, so all of that kind of stuff, you know, but it really, I was a late bloomer, and pretty much that's just because of the era that we lived in back then. You know, as women, I put it like this, everything back then was very gender specific. Mm-hmm. we had specific clothes we had to wear. I mean, it was dresses to school. You weren't in pants or anything. And certain jobs were open to women, and others you absolutely were not to think about, you know. Oh, that's not ladylike. And also for men, you know, it was not like cool for men to be nurses or any of those kind of things, even if they felt the calling. Mm-hmm. So it was a different time. And I bloomed at a later time, but I worked really hard then. I really started practicing 6 hours a day and absorbing the blues and, you know, just kind of stayed on that path.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk about your all-girls air guitar rock band. One of your first gigs was in an all-female band with Maggie Mael. Talk about that.
Well, actually, that was one of my first gigs when I moved back to Los Angeles. I had been playing in the Bay Area in various blues and R&B bands, and yet they weren't anything that was notable. You know, we were just, I was learning, I was playing in bars, and at a certain point in time, I decided to move back to L.A. to try and, you know, jump back into the big pond.
Mm-hmm.
And there were actually a lot of blues artists based out of L.A. then, you know, John Mayall and Bonnie Raitt, Albert Collins, you know, and then there was a big signing going on. They were signing like William Clark and, you know, all these guys that had been playing forever were suddenly getting their record deals, Little Charlie and the Nightcats and, you know, all the harp-based bands, Mighty Flyers. And so a lot of them were based in L.A., and there were jams that you could go to when they weren't on the road. So I was going to all those jams. And, yeah, I found out that Maggie Mael, John's wife, was putting together an all-female R&B blues band, and I auditioned and got that gig just from, you know, networking at the jams. And we became the opening band for John on his tours up and down the West Coast and through Colorado and such. And then we did our own thing. We started touring on our own too and really tried to get a record deal. But then we were kind of, the timing wasn't quite right. We were before mm-hmm. our time. They mm-hmm. weren't really signing women much to labels.
An all-female band on top of that, yeah.
Well, that was kind of popular because the Go-Go's and the Bangles were happening.
Okay, uh-huh.
But, you know, our music being more rootsy and bluesy was like, no, mm-hmm. no. And very shortly after that, they began signing all of the singer-songwriters, Tracy Chapman, and the gal who, you know, then put together the Lilith.
Oh, Sarah McLachlan.
Right. They were all getting signed, and then the Lilith Fair and all that happened mm-hmm. maybe, you know, 3 or 4 years after Maggie Mael and the Cadillacs. We broke up because you can only, you know, hit it so hard before you get discouraged if you're not getting a deal. So at that time, I also got an offer from Albert Collins.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked okay for me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, with when I was reading about you and putting together these questions, there's a lot of references to your work with Albert Collins. And there's an interesting quote that you said, it's one thing to listen to the records and pull off the licks or sit in the audience watching these artists play, but actually going out and touring with one turned the blues into something completely three-dimensional for me. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's like when you watch something or you listen to a record, that's kind of, it is what it is. I'm looking at that as two-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
Three-dimensional is actually being in the world. You know, it's, you're in there. And touring with Albert was kind of like walking through a door into the old blues because he still toured old blues style. Most of the band members were about 20 years older than me, you know. And we stopped in a lot of his old haunts in Houston and Dallas. And, you know, it was the after hours card games and the stories and, you know, the rib, all night greasy rib joints. And, you know, it was really living the life, the classic life of the blues. And I made a point always to sit up with Albert as he drove the bus, pour his coffee, you know, and talk to him and hear stories. And we got really close. It was like family. So mm-hmm. yeah, I was definitely experiencing the blues world and being on stage with them, even though I'd been in a number of bands. this was such a different experience. It was the most powerful band I'd ever been in. It was just, everybody played with such muscle. I mean, it was the real deal. So I guess I'm just seeing that in my mind as three-dimensional.
Yes, you said that you had to put your best out there when you were on stage playing with Albert. How did you keep that self-motivation and that attitude going when you ventured out solo shortly after working with Albert Collins?
Well, it was definitely a transition because, you know, I went from having zero responsibilities, you know, just getting on the bus and I had my little bunk and I could just crawl in there and fall back to sleep after all night partying or whatever. And Albert, of course, was headlining festivals then. So I went from that kind of touring to then being on the ground with my own, with a van and doing the driving and the navigating myself, the loading, the everything, and just trying to do it on my own, figure out the road on my own. Though I learned a lot, of course, from both Albert and the Mayalls. I saw how each of them approached the road, which was really opposite. So that was kind of cool. I could choose, you know, what was going to work for me. Because John was really organized. I mean, he's like anal organized. And Albert was like, oh, I don't really feel like heading out yet.
So you're probably somewhere in between, I'll bet.
That's where I am. Yes, yes. So it was very cool to see those two styles. But, you know, where were we?
We were talking about how it changed when you went out solo on the road and you had to pack the gear. And
oh, yeah. And it was, you know, it's certainly much harder in that way. But the exciting side of that was that I was getting to do my music now. And, you know, anything remains exciting while it's still new and challenging for me anyway. So, yeah, to bring it on stage every night like Albert did, that is like a work in progress. You know, I feel like I saw it, I absorbed it from him, but I am not him. I'll never be him. I'm finding my way more and more every year. And that's kind of how the blues is. It's you grow into it. You mature into it. You get better and better at it. It's not like the pop music where, okay, you're going to look young for two more years. We got to really push you now. And here's the clothes, here's the outfit, and here's the band. Bang. It's not like that at all. So, you know, it's a musician's music, and that's more where I'm coming from. So, yeah, there's always, it's never easy, but that's the challenge is the fun.
Definitely. I'm speaking with Debbie Davies. She's in concert tonight at Rock and Rodeo. Let's hear another song from your latest recording called Blues Blast. Tell us about this one, My Time After a While.
Well, this is a Buddy Guy tune, and I was reticent to record it for years just because, oh, it's Buddy Guy, man. I better not touch that. But I finally went, I always do this tune in my live shows, and for Blues Blast, which we were trying to just bring things that we could all jump in and play on, we had the, you know, concept of just recording pretty live in the studio, and I thought, well, this is a perfect tune. I'm going to do it, so Buddy Guy.
All right, Debbie Davies on KLCC's Fresh Tracks. We're going to talk about this great recording, Blues Blast, when we come back. Here's the tune. That is Debbie Davies on KLCC's Fresh Tracks. She is here live for a performance tonight at Rock and Rodeo, and she's in the KLCC studios. We're going to get to talking about that smoking album of yours with some players and some good listeners out there probably have guessed who some of these people are on it, but we'll get to that in a second. First, I want to talk to you about when did the songwriting process start for you, and how has it evolved 9 solo recordings later?
Well, I remember writing my first tune in high school on my acoustic guitar, and I wouldn't want to hear it now, but, you know.
I would never want to hear my first show either.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, you know, so definitely the writing thing was kind of part of it. The way I've come to look at it, is like I have three skills that I've had to develop to do what I do. And the guitar playing is one, singing is another, and songwriting is the other. And on some level, each one is a craft mm-hmm. to be perfected. And I think I've spent the most time on my guitar playing just because that was such a passion and took so much work. And at first I was so kind of isolated trying to do it and figure it out. And the singing, I'd always been singing, you know, since I was little. So I took that for granted, although I should have probably worked on that more. And then I came to realize after a while, wow, the songwriting's a craft too, because you get ideas. A couple of times a whole song has come to me at once for whatever reason. You know, the words, the chords, the whole song just sitting there. But a lot of times it's more like you get an idea for a song. It just, that might be the title, or you might get like a sentence or just a concept of what you want to write about. Or you might be sitting with your guitar. And you might come up with a riff or a musical idea. And it's like, wow, I want that to be a song. So the ideas come, and they can come when you're on the road or wherever. But then you have to actually, most of the time, put the time in to actually craft the song. Mm-hmm. And that can take, it can, every song is different. Some just, you know, you love where you're going, but you just can't finish it, or you can't find the bridge. And sometimes then it is when I'll bring in another songwriter and we'll co-write. Like my drummer is an unbelievably prolific songwriter. So we've co-written a lot. And plus, after a while, I just started accepting his tunes for my recording too. So I'm not somebody who writes constantly, mm-hmm. but I do write, and I do have things I want to write about. Sometimes they're fanciful and fun, and other times it might be something that's like really eating at me deeply, an emotional thing. So they're all crafts. They all take time and work.
Do you have a favorite artist that you like to cover the most? Is there a certain, I know you've done a lot of John Mayall tunes. You have an album that's a tribute to John Mayall.
Yeah. Well, John, you know, he was such an influence at so many various points in time that I felt like giving back, because, you know, the Blues Breakers were one of the first bands that turned my ear to blues with Eric Clapton's guitar playing. And those guys would be interviewed, and they would always be real sure to cite all of the American blues artists that influenced them. They were never just like, oh, we do this and we invented it. No. So John was a first influence in that way. And then when I moved back down to LA and became hooked up with Maggie and John in Maggie's band, John was so supportive. It's like he has always been a guy that has mentored guitar players mm-hmm. in all of his bands. And he became a mentor to me. He believed in what I was doing, and he has an unbelievable collection of music, movies, everything. Mm-hmm. So he turned me on to some obscure Freddie King and a lot of older stuff that he just had on tape that he had, you know, he really was a mentor. And so at that point that I made that record, I really wanted to give back, you know, and highlight him and his music. And other artists, if they're guitar players, I mean, there's so many that have affected me, mm-hmm. you know. It's hard to say. And for cover material, you know, I'll do still some Freddie King instrumentals. I'll do Buddy Guy, Albert King. And I would love to do, like, say, Etta James or Coco Taylor, but I do not see myself as having that kind of voice. Mm-hmm. Although I've occasionally done the same tunes they've done. So I don't know whose material I would choose from most as far as other artists. I guess I'd say classic blues artists. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the new album, Blues Blast. And you go ahead and take it over, Debbie.
Well, every time you make a record, both, you know, the artist and the record label tries to think of something a little different than has been done so they can sell it, so they can have a little marketing angle. So Telarc, the label I've been working with, wanted to do kind of an in-the-studio live party blues album. The album I recorded prior to this one was all originals by myself and my band. So it was all original tunes. This one, that was not the focus. It was, let's get some guests. Let's put emphasis on the playing and the coming together more than just on trying to highlight new songs. So let's bring songs that we're already comfortable with and that everybody can play. And Telarc used a rhythm section that they use a lot when they record, and that's Per Hansen on drums. Of course, he played with Ronnie Earl for years, mm-hmm. Ronnie Earl and the Broadcasters. Rod Carey on bass, same creds for him. And Bruce Katz, he's the cat, mm-hmm. you know. Of course, he does his own thing, and he plays with everybody else. he's just so wonderful. So they were there, and then we had Coco Montoya as a special guest, Charlie Musselwhite, and Tab Benoit. So they each do some contributions to the record.
Wow, that would be my dream come true to be with you all doing this.
Well, we did have some fun in there.
Yeah, I'll bet. And so it's kind of, as you were saying, like kind of like a live recording because you guys went in and...
Exactly.
You knew the songs and then mm-hmm. just started playing it. Is this one of your favorite albums?
It really is, but it's hard for me to sort of select a favorite. When I sell them, people are always, okay, which one's the best? Which one should I buy? And for me, at the time I'm making a record, I'm totally into it. And if I've written tunes for it, they're at the time really meaningful. So it's hard for me to pick a favorite because probably whichever one is new, I'm the most into.
Yeah. I was. You've been nominated for the Blues Music Award many times, 9, I believe. And you won for Best Contemporary Female Blues Artist in 1997. What's your next dream, Debbie?
That's
pretty big, what you've done so far.
Well, you know, at this point in time, just to be able to continue, you know, I'm just grateful to still be out here and grateful to still have my, you know, physicality that I need to do this and just to continue to be inspired and play and hopefully inspire some younger women to play and mm-hmm. perhaps at some point get to produce one, something like that. But other than that, I just keep carrying on.
All right. Well, we're glad you do. Debbie Davies plays Rock and Rodeo tonight. The concert begins at 8 o'clock. Thank you for stopping by the KLCC studios.
Well, thank you so much for supporting the blues, Liz.
Oh, yeah.
We appreciate it.
Thank you.